He had the information. He knew how dangerous it was. And while this deadly disease ripped through our nation, he failed to do his job.
Two very different men seeking the same political victory. It's Friday, September 11th, and this is VOA Asia. Coming to you from Washington, I'm Doug Bernard. Also ahead, what some call the love letters between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Cambodians express joy at the death of a feared Khmer Rouge commander. And COVID-19's toll on domestic violence. We'll have that and much more coming your way on VOA Asia. With the U.S. presidential campaign entering its final two-month stretch, both President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden are ramping up their travel to battleground states this week. But the candidates have very different approaches to getting their messages out to supporters. White House correspondent Patsy Wuduk-Swara has this report.
President Donald Trump travels to five battleground states this week: Florida, North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Nevada. He has resumed outdoor rallies in front of thousands of people, saying they're no different than the ongoing Black Lives Matter protests.
If you're willing to riot and stand on top of each other's face and do whatever the hell you want to do, you're allowed to do that because you're considered a peaceful protester. So we decided to call all our rallies peaceful protests.
Meanwhile, Democratic nominee Joe Biden meets supporters in small, socially distanced groups, including in Pennsylvania earlier this week.
So tell me about Joe.
Biden's campaign relies heavily on virtual events, seeking to portray their candidate as an empathetic leader who avoids putting people in harm's way.
Someone who will be at more intimate events and will listen to what people have to say. And that's part of the social justice aspect as well as the medical and economic aspects of his message. Whereas President Trump wants the big crowds. He wants to show that he has the support from what he calls the silent majority of Americans and that he is in this race and he still has a lot of followers.
On a Wednesday campaign event in Michigan, Biden slammed Trump with revelations from a forthcoming book by journalist Bob Woodward of the president admitting on tape in February that he downplayed the risk of the coronavirus to avoid causing panic.
He had the information. He knew how dangerous it was. And while this deadly disease ripped through our nation, he failed to do his job on purpose. It was a life and death betrayal of the American people.
We don't want to have to show panic. We're not going to show panic. And that's exactly what I did. And I was very open, whether it's to Woodward or anybody else.
Polls show voters are motivated by the pandemic and that most Americans are unhappy with Trump's handling of the coronavirus, something the Biden campaign is eager to highlight. But while Trump is trailing Biden in the polls nationally, the margins are razor thin, particularly in some battleground states.
Four more years!
Yeah, we get four more years. Guaranteed we're going to get four more years.
The Trump campaign has resumed traditional activities, including setting up local offices around the country and canvassing door to door. Biden advisors insist that their strategy of focusing on the pandemic and the economy, targeting different coalitions and affinity groups, is working. Still, some Democrats are nervous.
They're creating some enthusiasm with their events, and they are still knocking doors that were, because we're taking the pandemic so seriously, we're not doing. I am concerned that that's going to put us at a disadvantage.
On Friday, both Trump and Biden are scheduled to commemorate the anniversary of 9/11 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the crash site of United Flight 93, one of the airplanes hijacked by the terrorists. Patsy Wuduk-Swara, VOA News.
These are some of the Asia news headlines you can find right now on our website, voanews.com. U.S. revokes the visas of 1,000 Chinese students. Apple announces human rights policy following criticisms. Global Coalition calls for greater scrutiny of China on rights. And China and the U.S. vie for sympathy among wary Southeast Asian leaders. Much more on these stories and much more all on our website, voanews.com. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, U.S. President Donald Trump attracted a crowd of thousands to his latest political rally at a North Carolina airport this week. Mr. Trump marveled at a crowd he said totaled 15,000, a number that reporters on site says was exaggerated. Regardless, the key state of North Carolina is an important battleground for both campaigns in their race to the White House. We have this look at the politics of the Tar Heel state from Esha Sarai.
Staunch supporters of President Trump are confident he will carry North Carolina in November, but acknowledge it will be a tight race.
North Carolina is a swing state. People think, you know, it's, you know, if possibly could go. I can guarantee you that North Carolina will be going for President Trump. It's going to be a close race. I expect he'll carry North Carolina by 2-3 percentage points.
Joe Biden's supporters are working to rally support for the Democrat in North Carolina and getting varied reactions from voters.
It's mixed. It's about a mix. Today's been a lot of Biden. We're really surprised in this area. But on the freeways, a lot of birds. But it's been great. I need a better president. I need a president that can read and write and that can be for the people. So that's why we're here.
Democrat Barack Obama narrowly won North Carolina in 2008. The state went Republican in the next two elections by fewer than 4 percentage points. Recent polls have shown Biden leading the state by razor-thin margins.
Our state is very bitterly divided, but it's an even division between the partisans. And so the likelihood is both sides will get anywhere from 43 to 45, 46% of their respective votes. But it's that last sliver of persuadable voters that could flip from one side to the other that really makes North Carolina as competitive as any place else in the country.
In addition to the presidential race, North Carolina features a hotly contested Senate race that could help determine which party controls the legislative chamber. Esha Sarai, VOA News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Veteran Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward's new book, called Rage, is shining more light on the unlikely relationship between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The book won't be released until next week, but several U.S. media outlets this week have published excerpts, including portions of personal letters that Trump and Kim have exchanged over the past 2 years. We have more in this report from Bill Gallo in Seoul.
For his new book, entitled Rage, journalist Bob Woodward had access to 25 letters exchanged between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It is an unprecedented behind-the-scenes look at one of the most unexpected diplomatic relationships in world history. In the letters, Kim showers Trump with praise, repeatedly addressing him as Your Excellency and hailing their deep and special friendship. After their first meeting in Singapore in June 2018, Kim reportedly reminisced about holding Trump's hand. Kim called their second meeting in Hanoi a moment of glory that remains a precious memory. Trump returned the praise, calling Kim far beyond smart. According to the Washington Post, Trump boasted to Woodward that Kim tells me everything, including a graphic description of how he killed his uncle in 2013. The letters are grabbing headlines, but they may hurt the prospect of nuclear talks, said veteran Korea observer Mark Berry.
To have any excerpts of it published either in his book or as occurred today on CNN, you know, that's privileged diplomatic communications.
The matter is also tricky, Berry said, since Kim's words are typically treated with the utmost respect in authoritarian North Korea.
You don't misuse the great leader's words in a callous way. I mean, the worst that can happen is that internally, Kim could appear to be a supplicant to Trump.
North Korea has not responded to the release of the correspondence. But it may not be too surprised, since Trump previously tweeted out one of Kim's letters in July 2018. Trump and Kim didn't always get along. In 2017, the two regularly exchanged insults, with Trump calling Kim Little Rocket Man and Kim slamming Trump as a mentally deranged U.S. dotard. At one point, Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea. The tensions dissipated after Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to meet a North Korean leader. Trump later claimed the two fell in love. The relationship has held firm, even after North Korea last year resumed short-range ballistic missile tests and walked away from nuclear negotiations. If he wins re-election in November, Trump has said he will reach a deal very quickly with Kim. Trump's opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, has said he will not continue Trump's personal outreach to Kim, signaling a return to a more traditional U.S. posture. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Here's one of the stories that we're tracking at VOA News. Tokyo has lowered its COVID-19 alert status to the second highest level on Thursday as the new number of cases continues to drop. The government announced it will loosen restrictions on nighttime activity. For more on this story, visit us at voanews.com. Cambodians have greeted the death of Khmer Rouge Commandant Kang Guk U, also commonly known as Doik, with a mixture of happiness, sorrow, and relief as this country continues to move on from its tragic past. With more, Piers reporter Luke Hunt.
Doik ran the S21 death camp, which processed more than 16,000 people for execution between 1975 and 1979. He was serving a life sentence for crimes against humanity when he died last week. His conviction was one of three obtained at a UN-backed court, which found the former math teacher and born-again Christian had established a prototype torture centre that would serve as a model for S21 and 196 similar camps. At S21, meals were rare. Beatings, electrification and disembowelment were common, and death inevitable, but the tribunal and the deaths of nearly all senior Khmer Rouge leaders has enabled Cambodia to move on from its tragic past. Mao Tal has worked at Chung Ek since 1980 and says Cambodians were relieved that nearly all senior leaders of the Khmer Rouge were dead. Both of his parents died of starvation under Cambodian leader Pol Pot.
The people that see that they die, Cambodian people happy because Cambodia had done like Khmer Rouge people angry because Khmer Rouge kill our family.
Sokna Prum is typical of many young Cambodians. A professional who works as an administrator for an art gallery, she says the youth of today must learn from the horrendous crimes of the past.
Nobody regret about his death, I think, but the another regret is that the justice was not really found. This guy kill a lot of people, but he death like peacefully. I don't think the victims would be satisfied about his death.
While many older Cambodians remain haunted by Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal and the passing of those responsible for the slaughter of about 2 million people has helped Cambodia move on from its tragic past. Luke Hunt for VOA News, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
Here's what's making news right now in Asia. The United States is pressing authorities in Afghanistan to bring justice to an influential former head of the South Asian country's soccer federation who is on the run from criminal charges of sexually assaulting multiple female players. More on this story at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA Asia, coming to you from Washington, D.C. A Department of Homeland Security official said in a whistleblower complaint released Wednesday that he was pressured by more senior officials to suppress facts in intelligence reports than President Trump might find objectionable, including information about Russian interference in the election and the rising threat posed by white supremacists. International Edition's Lori London spoke to VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden for details on the allegations.
This is a complaint that was filed earlier this week by Brian Murphy, who had been the Department of Homeland Security's principal deputy undersecretary in the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. So he's a senior official involved in just about all aspects of the intelligence operations for the Department of Homeland Security, a key advisor to the Secretary of Homeland Security. And he held that position for a couple of years. So there during Trump's second Homeland Security Secretary, Kristen Nielsen, and the current acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf. And he says there are several incidents over the past couple of years during which he was told by superiors, including the former Secretary of Homeland Security and the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, to alter his intelligence analysis so it would better mirror the narrative that was coming from the White House. And he said he refused to do that. And as a result, he was demoted. And instead of being in charge of intelligence analysis, he became the Assistant Deputy Undersecretary for Management.
What are the implications in this narrative?
The implications, if this is true, are significant because it would mean that senior Trump administration officials, including in the Department of Homeland Security and in the White House, purposefully were telling officials, intelligence officials, to change their analysis, to change their assessments of the security situation to match the policies that the Trump administration wanted to push. For example, Murphy alleges that in November of 2018 and in May of 2019, he was asked by senior Homeland Security officials to change his analysis about how many terrorists, known or suspected terrorists, were coming into the country across the border with Mexico. And he said, according to his complaint, there were only three, and these three known or suspected terrorists really only had contacts. They had phone numbers of people who were known to be in touch with actual terrorists. But he says the Department of Homeland Security and then Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen testified there were almost 4,000 known or suspected terrorists crossing the southern border. Back during that time period, VOA reported that counterterrorism officials, not with the Department of Homeland Security, said there was no evidence to suggest either terrorists affiliated with the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda were trying to cross the border. But DHS continued with that narrative supported by the White House. Another allegation, Murphy said that in mid-May of this year and also in July of this year, he was told to stop disseminating or sharing any intelligence regarding Russian activities, Russian disinformation efforts with the upcoming presidential election. In fact, he says he was told by the acting Homeland Security Secretary to focus on providing intelligence about what China and Iran are doing to influence the outcome of elections. He said he refused because that would mean to put the U.S. in a perilous position because the intelligence, he says, indicated that Russia was doing stuff and it's information that the president needed to know. So these are the types of things he says have happened. He also said that there was an attempt by Ken Cuccinelli, another top Homeland Security official, to have him focus more on Antifa as opposed to white nationalists, again, to match the narrative, the rhetoric that was coming from the White House.
Jeff, it's interesting that Mr. Murphy, that his name is out in the open, that he wasn't trying to hide it. A lot of these whistleblowers try to stay anonymous. So what happens next here?
It's interesting. According to the complaint, Murphy these grievances with the Office of Inspector General, but today it was released by the House Intelligence Committee.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden speaking with our Lori London. A spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security has since released a statement in response to the allegations, saying, quote, "The department generally does not comment on the specifics of OIG referrals, but we flatly deny that there is any truth to the merits of Mr. Murphy's claim. DHS looks forward to the results of any resulting investigation, and we expect it will conclude that no retaliatory action was taken against Mr. Murphy." As Acting Secretary Wolf outlined in his State of the Homeland address today, DHS is working to address all threats to the homeland, regardless of ideology, unquote.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Reports of domestic violence in at least 14 American cities have risen sharply since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, a new study confirms. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias examined how the virus has increased the risk of abuse and what victims and the groups that help them are doing to stop it.
Everyone always says, oh, well, why didn't that person just leave? They must, you know, somehow like secretly this treatment. But the truth is, abuse is a cycle.
It was like living with a ticking bomb, says this survivor of domestic violence, who did not want her name used for safety reasons.
I finally reached the point where I felt that if I did not leave the marriage, that I would be dead within a year, either because he would have killed me, I might have committed suicide, or the stress of living in the situation was so severe that I would get cancer or something like that.
But that was before the pandemic. Her full-time job in an office and the ability to have face-to-face contact with friends and relatives helped her get out of danger. Now, with COVID-19, it is harder than ever for victims of domestic abuse to break free.
We see more abusers using COVID as a technique to hold power and control over their victims. So they'll either not let someone leave the house and threaten them, if you leave, you can't come back in because you'll have COVID, or not letting them leave the house in the first place.
What we've noticed is that we're serving the same number of people, but the situations are so much more dangerous. Cases involving strangulation, cases involving firearms, cases involving other weapons. We've seen a massive increase in these types of cases.
At least 14 cities have seen an uptick in domestic abuse reports, according to researchers.
We used calls made to the police during 2020, and then we compared them with calls during 2019, and we found that the increase was about 7.5% during March, April, and May. Most areas and most racial groups and income groups had similar effect sizes, and we found evidence of large increases for new households.
What worries prosecutors even more is that victims, especially minors, can't seek help.
Children who may have been able to go to school and perhaps report what's happening in their home are now doing remote learning. So there's no opportunity to speak to that trusted adult in their school to let them know what's happening in their home.
But help is still available.
I'm just going to start off by gathering a little bit of information from you.
Victims can call hotlines. They can seek protective orders from authorities. And therapists at groups like Doorways are available online.
We work on creating a safety plan to identify triggers, to identify unsafe locations, whether that be, you know, if they see that their partner is becoming escalated, you know, moving out of the kitchen, you know, because that's where weapons can be.
The survivor says healing is possible, but it takes courage and patience to break out of an abusive cycle.
These situations have a way of destroying your soul and making you doubt everything about yourself. So what I would say is be gentle with yourself. Don't think that there's something wrong with you if you got out 3 months ago and you're not walking on clouds. It takes a very long time. I'm still a work in progress, as we all are.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Chevy Chase, Maryland.
And that is VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us. We'll be back with you again next week. We hope you will as well. And until then, take care.